Great to have you with us on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mehler here. And today on the show, we're actually starting by talking about reducing food waste. Julie Schilf is our guest today. She's the program coordinator for the Sustainable Management of Food with EPA in Region 5. Julie works in materials management, where she helps businesses and individuals improve their food sustainability practices. So, wondering how you can help reduce food waste, or do you have questions about maybe leading a sustainable life? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Julie Schilf, welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me.
So you are the coordinator for EPA in Region 5, and I'm thinking that includes Wisconsin, Illinois, Ohio, Minnesota, Michigan, and
Indiana. Yeah.
So let's talk about food waste in that district. What's it like?
I think food waste in across Region 5 is pretty similar to the national numbers. So for example, we estimate in the U.S. that, like you said, a third of the available food supply goes to waste in the U.S. And that is pretty similar to what's happening from state to state. It's about a third in each state. Maybe about between 20 and 25% of food that ends up in our landfills is similar across each state as well. In Wisconsin, in particular, the last measurement from 2020 to 2021 shows that organics made up just over 30% of the materials that ended up in your landfills there.
That's a lot. What is it about our way of life that leads to the amount of food waste that we make?
It's funny you say that. We were talking about this before the show started. I think that we live dynamic lifestyles, right? Where we want to see family and friends, and maybe like I was saying earlier, 2 days ago I took some chicken out of the freezer. Thought was going to make tonight. Well, actually tonight I decided to go get my haircut and meet a friend out for a drink. And I know that when I get home, I may not want to make that chicken. So little things like that happen. We have kids, everyone has kids, are active in sports, and we live dynamic lives.
Frank in Oshkosh has a comment that relates to this. So let's go to Frank. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Frank.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for taking my call. This is one major contributor to food waste in America. I've been watching this issue for years, and I know I'm not alone in it. All of the food waste from our grocery stores, all of the food waste from our convenience stores, okay? Most of these corporations have policies that will not allow them to have nonprofit organizations come and pick up this food, which is past its sell-by date, but is still perfectly good and healthy and safe for human consumption, to be rounded up so it can get redistributed through our food pantry networks, mm-hmm. our homeless shelters, our meals for schools, and other community outreach activities.
Frank makes an interesting point here. Julie, is that in your area?
Yeah, it's really important to discuss this, because a lot of grocery stores and retail businesses are afraid that they'll be liable, right? But there is something called the Bill Emerson Good Samaritan Food Donation Act that actually protects donors from civil liability. So, you know, there's no reason for businesses and retails to be afraid from donating food to those who need it. And I should say that, you know, we're wasting all this food, right? And this goes to the caller's concerns. We're wasting all this food. Much of it is perfectly wholesome and edible. And the USDA estimates that over 12% of US households are food insecure, meaning they don't know where their next wholesome and nutritious meal is coming from.
Yeah, that's a terrible number, 12%. Oh, my goodness.
It is. That's really high. That was from their 2022 numbers, I believe it is.
So how did the EPA get involved in this, or how much is the EPA involved with this effort to curb food waste?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, EPA has been addressing wasted food for years, over 20 years, but only in the last, I'd say, 15 has it really come to our attention that it's impacting our lives through emissions, greenhouse gas emissions. Food that ends up in landfills contributes to greenhouse gas emissions through methane. And methane, as we know, is a harmful greenhouse gas over 20 times more potent than carbon dioxide.
Yeah. Well, if your food does go to a landfill, how long does it take to break it down and turn it back into soil? In other words, how maybe talk about that versus a compost pile.
Well, food in landfills actually makes up, we just did a study, makes up about 58% of the fugitive methane emissions. And food has a relatively quick decay rate. So its emissions often occur before even landfill gas collection systems can grab that. So it's really quick in the first year that it happens, and then the emissions are much slower over maybe the next 20 years.
Yeah.
So what composting is great. There are some emissions associated with composting, sure, but the real benefit there is that you're turning this food scrap into a nutrient-rich soil amendment. And we can put that back into the soil, right? We need that.
Carl in Eagle River, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Carl.
Hi. Thank you for your call, for allowing me to bring up this subject here. We use four different methods. First of all, you know, kids and adults hate leftovers, so we take all our leftovers, and instead of trying to serve them and throw them away, we make hash out of them. So it looks totally different. You add a few eggs. The other thing we do is we use surplus stores where they have overruns and outdated products and such. And we use those quite a bit. And we also shop the area in the grocery stores where they have closeouts. And instead of them just throwing it away, we purchase those items. And then the last thing we do is we use chickens. You know, any of our leftovers go to chickens, and you get, instead of composting them, you get eggs out of them. So it's four-win situation.
Carl, thanks for that's getting into one section that we did want to talk about, was what can we do to reduce our own food waste. And it sounds like Carl has hit on some good ideas there, Julie.
He really has, and I really want to point out something Carl mentioned, which was upcycling, right? He's using food scraps and turning them into newer edible food products. And while this often happens in food manufacturing, we do it at home and we don't even think about it. You know, we can make croutons out of stale bread. We often make stocks and broths out of inedible vegetable scraps, for example. And I think that's a really great action that people can take at home.
Yeah. Connie in Marshfield, on to you now. Hi, Connie.
Hi. One of the problems I see is that it could be attitude 20, 30 years ago, worried about children's self-esteem to be higher. I babysat with a couple of little girls once. She wanted an apple. I cut it up. I gave it to her, and she cried till her parents got home. And the problem was their father just gave her a whole apple. She took one bite. She stopped crying, and she threw it in the garbage. So I think some of this, us old folks, we understand the food process and how you need to use it up because it's hard to come by. But I don't think people are educated enough in that department.
Connie, thank you for calling. Julie, you're going to agree with that? Or?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that what Connie says kind of reflective of back maybe during the World War II, when it was actually patriotic to preserve and reduce the amount of food you're wasting. And I think that's something that we should be carrying into today. It's patriotic to help people in our communities by feeding them. It's patriotic to reduce, to actually use what farmers are putting into the human food system, right? So it's a matter of attitude and behavior.
Connie, thanks again. Let's go to Dan in La Crosse. Hi, Dan. Dan, are you there? Maybe we lost Dan. Must have lost him. He had written some songs about food waste. I wish I had the songs. We'd play one in the background. So I'm sorry about that. You can join in, by the way. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email us to ideas@wpr.org. Talking with Julie Shilf today. She is the program coordinator for the sustainable management of food with EPA in Region 5. And I hope you'll join in with your own comments or suggestions. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert is our producer today. Our technical director is Trina LaSousa. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today on WPR. Larry Mueller here as we talk about reducing food waste at home with our guest, Julie Shilf of the EPA in Region 5. She's the program coordinator for the sustainable management of food in our region, which is Region 5. Again, you can join us 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. I was thinking about food waste and ways to reduce waste of food at home. You know, I live alone most of the time. My daughter comes home to visit once in a while from college, but I don't go to stores like Costco or Sam's Club because there's the food's in bulk and I might be a little bulky, but I'm not really ready for the bulk supplies that those kind of stores sell.
Yeah, actually, I'm the same way. I live alone. I've never been to a Costco. That's not to say that they're not useful for some people. But if you're buying perishables at Costco in large amounts, it's most likely that they're being wasted at home. But there are tips you can do. There are so many ways to prevent wasted food, and not at home, but also at the grocery store. You know, you can plan your shopping, do your planning and shopping ahead of time. You know, shop your kitchen before you go shopping. Look in your refrigerator, freezer, and pantry, and avoid buying what you don't need. And then only buy what you do need and eat what you buy, right? Plan your meals ahead for the week. Buying in from bulk bins can save you money. So, for example, not necessarily buying in bulk as in large, but buying loose fruits and vegetables and unpackaged food is a great way to reduce what you're wasting at home and also reduce packaging waste as well.
Dan in La Crosse is back with us, I think. Let's go there. Dan, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'm a songwriter and substitute teacher. One of my songs is called Hot Potato. It's about sharing food resources. Another is called Junior Mind Your Manners. Junior the pig's mother says, Junior Mind Your Manners, you're acting like a people again. Could I sing you just a little bit of Hot Potato?
All right. Well, give me a line or two here then, Dan. Okay. Let's hear it.
Okay. Hot potato country, hot potato town, hot potato given to be passed around. Hot potato holder, holding on so hard, pretty soon your fingers gonna all get charred.
All right. Well, what do you think, Julie?
Oh, I love that. And if you please email me a link if you have that on online somewhere.
Dan, can you how do people actually reach you in one way or another through EPA?
Actually, you can find my contact info online on EPA's Sustainable Management of Food webpage, or you can email me directly at ILF@julie.gov.
Okay. julie.epa.gov, right?
Correct.
And your name is the SCHILF is SCHILF.
Correct. I as in igloo, L like Larry, and F as in Frank.
So it's shilf.julie?
Correct. At epa.gov.
There we go. There you go, Dan. Send those songs along to Julie, will you? Oh, that sounds great. And probably working on children there, or maybe, but, you know, it's kind of fun to listen to myself, as a matter of fact. I don't mind it at all. So do send that along. We'd appreciate it. Colette in northern Wisconsin, we'll go to you. Hi, Colette.
Okay. I want to just talk about an example of food waste in grocery stores. I work at a grocery store in a small town in northern Wisconsin, and I don't want to say which one because I work there and I want to keep working there. There are two stores in this town. One is a national chain. One is an independent that has a few stores in northern Wisconsin. And the national chain, they will put things out if they get close to their expiration date in both fresh food and in, like, groceries. So at a lower price, so people, because up here up north there's not a lot of money, so people can buy things at a produce or at a lower cost. The locally owned store throws, I bet, 1,000 pounds of food a week away. They refuse to offer it to employees. They won't send it to the food shelf. They won't offer it to the community. They just throw it away. I have seen, and I wonder, there's been cases where they deliberately were giving it to the employees and go, we can't let the employees have that for free. So because they can't, they have to throw it away. So I'm wondering if there'd be like a legislative, this is something, you know, a normal employee, they just, maybe it's something that kind of has to be legislated to try and reduce food waste from, because the amount, the food not only is not being used, it's filling up the landfills.
Yeah, Julie, you did talk about that earlier. There's some laws already on the books about it.
There is. Thank you for that information, actually. And I mentioned this earlier, the Bill Emerson Good Samaritan Food Donation Act, it includes protections for direct donations to individuals in need by qualified direct donors. So under this act, there is, you know, as long as the donor hasn't acted with any kind of, you know, intentional harm, the donor is not liable for damage, or there's no civil liability associated with that food donation should anyone get sick from it. And there's information on our webpage about this. This is a federal act that protects people and donors who want to help people. And we have a whole page on food donation you can check out, where you can learn more about this and how you can donate food in your own community as well.
So, Julie, how does Colette, or anybody else for that matter, find that page? How do you do that?
epa.gov/sustainable-management-food.
Ooh, that's all. Yeah. Is there an easier way? We can post.
Actually, there is. Google EPA food waste, and it'll come up.
Oh, Colette, you hear that? EPA food waste. Put that in your search engine, and that'll come up.
And Colette, I encourage you to find that information on our webpage. Arm yourself with as much information as you can and take it to that grocery store and let them know that they could be donating to a local food pantry in the area and helping those in need.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Colette, thank you very much for calling. I hope you follow up. Terry in Milton, your turn. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for letting me call. I was just thinking when that little girl that threw that apple away, I just bought a whole bag of apples from Washington State. I ate one apple, and I wash it first. I threw the whole bag away after that first apple. And the reason for that is because the quality of the food in this country is getting worse all the time. I've been around long enough that at one time they told us that if there's more than four ingredients on the package, we shouldn't even eat it. Now we got 43 ingredients on the packages. No wonder we throw the food away. It's terrible.
Well, Julie, comment.
Well, in grocery stores, you know, to kind of follow that up, grocery stores also incentivize consumers to buy more, right? So buy four, get one free, right? And I think that's contributing to a lot of wasted food in our society. And retailers have a responsibility here. And I've mentioned this earlier. I think there's something that they can be doing, and that's making loose fruit and vegetables an attractive offer. Instead of packaging a whole bunch together as one sale, make them individual. Loose fruit and vegetables could be a great way. So, you know, next time you go to the store, try to buy, you know, one or two apples. Buy what you know you're only going to eat.
Yeah, absolutely. I usually go and we have a loose apple section, for example, and since I typically take an apple to work every day for my part of my lunch, I just buy five apples.
That's nice.
Rather than the whole bag, works a lot better for me.
I think that's also an opportunity to engage customers through education, right? Maybe people aren't aware of how much food waste is impacting our environment, our natural resources, our economy, and our society.
It's a big sink. It's costing us money individually, but then in the long run for the environment, as you were talking about earlier, it's the amount of methane produced in garbage is great. It's just a kind of a no-win situation at all the way around when we're wasting the food. Victor and Poplar will give you a chance. Hi, Victor.
Hi, Larry. I like buying the pre-roasted chickens from the grocery store. The price is better than buying a whole chicken. I don't have to turn the oven on. And then we get two, three meals out of them. But when we're done with all that, including all the jelly, I cook it down, religiously pick through it, and kind of make a chicken jelly for the dogs.
Oh.
They love it.
And they love it.
especially if you're going to give them any medication.
Yeah. Victor, thank you for calling. Comment on that, Julie.
Thanks for sharing. That's an interesting and innovative way to keep that food from ending up in the trash.
Yeah. Billy in Monona, we'll go to you. Hi, Billy.
My concern is you talked about liability issues. Well, a grocery store, for example, they're concerned about what happens to the product after it leaves the store. So if it's mishandled, not prepared properly, and the people get sick, all of a sudden in the paper it says, this food came from Woodman's and these people got sick. You know, and then and nobody really reads things that finds out that it was mishandled properly and blah, blah, blah. And so they're reluctant to give that stuff away to anybody because of those kind of reputation problem situations.
Hmm.
And that's all I got to say.
Billy, thank you. Comment, Julie?
Well, that's understandable, but it's not clear who's making the donation here. Is it the grocery store, or is someone who got the food from the grocery store making the donation, right? And you have to remember, under the Bill Emerson Good Samaritan Act, in order to be protected, that food must be handled properly. And a lot of health agencies and departments, whether it's a local municipal health department, they have a lot of rules around this too, and especially about how food safety and how food should be handled.
Billy, thank you for calling. I think he was also referring to the potential public relations. The grocery store is concerned about some public relations thing. If somebody gets sick from eating the food, it's blamed on the store rather than it's the person's fault.
Yeah, it looks bad. I think we need to just educate more people on food safety and how we can use the Bill Emerson Act in our favor, right?
Yeah. Wayne in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning. Thank you. I have two comments. One was I find out that I lose less food by throwing it out if I actually plan ahead and actually have a specific meal to be made. Otherwise, like with Julie, you made the comment about you come home at night and you were busy and you're planning on going out tonight and you have chicken pulled. You're not going to want to make the chicken tonight, and then it might sit there or whatever. I do that a lot. And where if I don't have a specific plan for it, I'll end up sitting there and then kind of look in the fridge and go, oh, there's nothing good, and then end up wasting it later. And then the other thing is, too, is that I find that some of the more expensive stuff, actually, if you handle it right, once you get it home, it saves you money. Produce is a big example on waste on that. When I wash strawberries when I get them home, I wash bananas, believe it or not. There's a ripening agent they spray on bananas that I just found out about a year ago. And their bananas stop ripening if you actually wipe them off. They don't ripen so fast, so I don't get black bananas right away. And strawberries last longer if you wash them off, fold up a paper towel and set it in the bottom of a container, and then put the strawberries back in. They don't rot as fast. And stuff like that, you know, the way you store your herbs. I clean all my herbs right away, spray them off, and dry them best I can, and then put a paper towel around them and set them in a plastic bag that's open on one end, and they seem to last a lot longer. Anyway, you get my point. There's some things I waste because I'm lazy, and other things I go way out of my way to save because I'm not. So anyway, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Wayne, for calling. Julie, a comment?
Thanks, Wayne. I'm really glad you brought that up. It's something we haven't discussed yet, and that's storage. You know, properly storing your fruits and vegetables, it maximizes their freshness. They taste better. They last longer. And when your fruits and vegetables last longer, you're more likely to eat them and therefore eat healthier. And that's another thing I'm guilty of. If I run out of fresh fruits and vegetables or food, sometimes I'm going to run down to McDonald's instead of going all the way to the store to buy more, right? It's easier and faster to just run out and get fast food. So the longer we can make these fruits and vegetables last, the more likely we are to eat them as well. And there are a number of storage guides and tips all over the internet that you can use. SaveTheFood.com has an interactive storage guide with tips and tricks on doing just that. You can identify specific items like Wayne just did, and it will tell you where and how you should be storing them.
Well, you know, as I don't know, I can't remember if you mentioned this, but different parts of the fridge are warmer than others.
They are.
The door is the warmest, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, you can store condiments there, but it's not recommended to store milk or eggs in the door, right? And the lower shelves are the coldest part, obviously, and that's where you want to keep your meat, poultry, and fish.
And usually, I think my refrigerator has a particular tray for fruits and vegetables. So I think it's moisture or something.
Yeah, there's a humidifier. One side has should have humidity levels, right? And that's really good for items like broccoli. You know, there should be a little bit of moisture in there to keep broccoli fresh longer.
Mary Kay in Kenosha, your turn. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hello. What I'd like to say is the fruits and veggies that we buy are bitter because they're putting a lot of chemicals on them and additives to make them last longer. Most people just buy enough that they need. So I make smoothies out of odds and ends, you know, fruits and vegetables. I mulch. You can grow your own vegetables. You can start manufacturing peat and vegetable containers, and you can have biofuels.
All of those things, Julie.
I love all of that. That's great. I especially love the growing your own, right? If you're concerned about, you know, fruits and vegetables having some kind of chemical or pesticide on them, grow your own. If you don't have room in your backyard, you can grow inside your house on your own counter, even if it's just a little bit. It's helpful. And when you do grow your own, you will waste less.
So I want to also ask you about the distinctions between the wording on packages. You've got use by and sell by dates on food products. And the use by is different from the sell by.
It sure is. I'm glad you brought this up. So there are four different phrases that are commonly used in the U.S. That retailers and manufacturers use. I should preface all of this by saying that the government does not regulate any of this except for baby formula, infant formula, right? That's the only one that has a safety date. So I'm going to go through each of these, and I hope that it really helps your listeners. I hope it helps clarify what these mean for your listeners. So the first one is best if used by / before. And this indicates when a product will be of its best flavor or quality. It's not a purchase or safety date. Sell by is a date that tells the store how long to display the product for inventory management. It's not a safety date. Use by is a date that's the last date recommended for the use of the product while it's at its peak quality. It's not a safety date, and this is except for when used on infant formula. And then there's a freeze by date, right, which indicates when a product should be frozen in order to maintain its peak quality. Also not a purchase or safety date. And I think there's a big responsibility here for food manufacturers and retailers. And the USDA suggests that they use the best if used by date consistently to reduce consumer confusion.
The sell by date. But the sell by date doesn't mean that that's when it's over with.
I think that's more for the store to say how long they can be out for their inventory management, right? They're constantly rotating inventory.
Yeah, it makes sense. Katie in Eau Claire has something for us. Hi, Katie.
Good morning. Something I like to do with my fruit and vegetables for storage is wash them up, and then I use brown coffee filters to help absorb the moisture before I put them into a glass container and put it back in the refrigerator. The brown coffee filters I can throw right into my composting bin, and that works slick. Our local community table gets extra produce from Target that they aren't able to sell, but boy, you cut off some brown spot, mince up cauliflower, and they sneak it into the Sloppy Joe mix or the spaghetti sauce. Citrus fruits are squeezed out to add in the vitamin C to any of their salad dressings. Wouldn't think that scurvy is a problem up here, but apparently it is with our food insecure population. So a couple of good tips there.
Oh, Katie, thank you very much. Julie, we're getting lots of good tips here.
We are. Katie, that is awesome. And I have to tell you, I've never heard the tip about the coffee filter, and I really appreciate that. I'm going to pass that along to my colleagues.
Yeah. So for people to also to find out more, let's go back to your website, the EPA website, and give us that information. Because there's I went on the site. There's a ton of stuff on there.
There's so much information, and it's great. And we have a whole section on what individuals and communities can do, not only to prevent wasted food at home, but in your community, about composting and donating, and then educating our kids about wasted food as well. There's information there on that too. So you want to visit epa.gov/sustainable-management-food.
Or if you put in EPA food management.
You can Google EPA food waste and it will come up.
That's what I was looking for. We can post that. Clara can put that up on the official dress up on our page, ideas@wpr.org/Larry. And listeners know they can go there and get that information. In fact, Clara just sent me a note and says, hey, it's already up. So we've got it up on our page. Julia, real pleasure. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. I hope we have a chance to do this again.
Yeah, me too. Thanks for having me. And I really appreciate all of your callers today. Thank you.
Julie Schilf is the program coordinator for the Sustainable Management of Food with EPA in Region 5, which is our region. Well, another place that's in our region and in our state is the Driftless area. And we're going to take a look at trout streams in the Driftless area and what's being done to save those streams. And we're also going to talk a little bit about trout fishing, because our guest, Peter Jonas, he's better trout fisherman than I am. I'm pretty sure of that. And he might have some tips along those lines as well. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, decades of agriculture in the Driftless area led to the deterioration of many trout streams. And there are people, though, that are working to help the environment and the fish in that area. And we'll be talking about the Driftless area restoration efforts with our guest, Peter Jonas. Peter is the Driftless Area Partnership Specialist for Trout Unlimited. And in addition to hearing about stream restoration, Peter will also share how you might get involved with fly fishing and with trout fishing. So I hope you'll join in. What do you know about fly fishing, for example? Tell us about the stream restoration efforts in your area. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Peter Jonas, welcome. Thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Larry. I'm happy to be here.
Let's talk about Trout Unlimited to begin. Tell us about the work of Trout Unlimited.
Trout Unlimited is a fabulous organization. We like to think of it as a conservation organization with a fishing problem. So we have 6,000 members across the state, and in addition to our work in the Driftless, we have a Great Lakes team that is doing fabulous works on the Great Lakes tributaries. We have active chapters in the Central Sands area and all over the state doing marvelous conservation work.
Let's zero in a little on the Driftless area restoration effort. What is really the goal there?
The Driftless Area Restoration Effort, we really have three overarching projects that we work on. The largest and the central one is really our stream restoration efforts. So in the 20 years since the Driftless Area Restoration Effort, or we call it TUDARE, has existed, we have restored over 350 miles of trout streams. So that's 17 and a half miles a year. And then following that, we've begun doing work on fish and aquatic organism passage. So we have crews going around the Driftless that are looking at culverts, bridges, other impairments to streams, evaluating them for both fish passage concerns and for flood resiliency. And we're sharing this information with municipalities and want to partner with them to eliminate fish passage obstacles. And then the third thing is we're creating a conservation portfolio of the Midwest, and that's really designed to get as much knowledge as possible about where brook trout are at, because they are our native species and they are the most vulnerable. So we want to have all of the scientific data possible to provide the best habitat solutions and the best policy solutions to see them continue on.
That's a lot there, and I think you indicated partnerships, and I probably do some work. I was thinking of my daughter who had an internship last summer where she was doing water quality and
is that right?
And doing some did a little fish shocking in streams too as part of a DNR research project, and I imagine you folks work with them as well.
We do. You know the old saying, it takes a village to raise a child, and it takes a lot of partners to restore a trout stream. We work with the Department of Natural Resources, but our two main funding partners are actually the Fish and Wildlife Service through the Department of Interior and the National Fish Habitat Partnership Program, and the Natural Resources Conservation Service. And we work through them through the Regional Conservation Partners Program. And between those two federal programs, $1 million is spent every year on stream restoration in the four states of the Driftless region. And a lot of that money then has to be matched, or it has to be supplemented with additional resources. And that's where our TU local chapters come in. A lot of state programs can be used for these match through our county conservation projects. We also partner with organizations like Pheasants Forever, for example, in terms of planting native species and riparian corridors, and many other conservation organizations. Friends of Wisconsin Wetlands were it's so important to find ecosystem solutions to conservation problems.
Hmm. Richard in Two Rivers has something for us. Let's go there.
All right.
Hi, Richard.
Hey, Larry. How you doing?
Good.
On break, so I'll make it quick. I'm going fishing a couple weeks for the opener down in Minnesota, but I actually fish the northeast corner of Iowa, and I got secret streams that have brookies in them, big ones. But I got brook right in front of my house here in Two Rivers. I live across the Shoto Dam, and they plant some, but you also get some that come up from the lake, and that's right at the Shoto Dam there.
Yeah,
it is. I think the Lake Michigan tributary fisheries, while that isn't my professional area of interest, it's certainly an area of interest of mine as a angler, and we have some spectacular opportunities. I was fishing in downtown Milwaukee the week after Christmas for those sea florellan brown trout, and they are massive brown trout. And I thought I'd be the only lunatic out there. And it was jumping. I mean, there were so many people out there fishing with all different methods. I thought, this is fantastic in the center of our largest urban area to have a fishery like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Richard, thanks a lot for calling Ross in Crawford County. What's on your mind? Ross, need to get...
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Ross.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I've got property in eastern Crawford County. I've got it's a stream, Knapp Creek, and it feeds into the Wisconsin River down by Wazeek, I believe. And the question I have is, I think the stream was probably straightened, I'm just going to say 100 years ago, or whenever the initial farmers came in, and then as time marched on, they realized that the agriculture in some of those valleys just wasn't any good, it was too wet. And so we have a stream that has brook and brown trout, and but when we had these heavy rains, it turned into just a big channel, and I'm wondering about remeandering the stream. That is, I probably have like about 10 acres in length, so I'm not sure if it, you know, but so it's straightened probably on both sides. But I'm just wondering if it's worth to remeandering to kind of mitigate some of those floodwaters. Instead of rushing down the stream, they might be able to spread across the land a little bit, and how I would go about that.
Yeah.
You are exactly the type of landowner we want to talk to. I will say that. And the short answer is yes, remeandering is possible. It can be an expensive project, but I would not let that scare you off, because it is also a project that many, many partners are interested in supporting for a whole variety of reasons. We do have a lot of straightened streams in the Driftless region, and remeandering just provides many, many environmental benefits. So I would encourage you. I'm wondering, it's Ross, right? We're speaking with Ross.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if we can get his contact information, the producers offline perhaps. And I would love to have a further conversation with you about that, because you can do a real environmental solid for the land that you're a steward of.
So, Ross, hang on there, and I think Clara will be able to grab, I think she's going to be able to grab your information so that Peter can get a hold of you after the show's over at some point.
You bet. I would like to do that.
Appreciate your call very, very much. So the whole business of restoration in the first place, it's amazing. Well, if you look at a lot of the streams, like the Kickapoo area, for example, those are meandering. They look like kind of like snakes going through the water. And But they serve a real purpose.
Oh, yes. I mean, when streams are straightened and you lose a natural riparian corridor, you create all kinds of problems downstream, although we've been able to work with them. And in some instances, depending on what funding is available, we can do solutions that aren't a complete meander. But when we can get an opportunity to return a stream back to its natural function, that's really what we want to go for. And there is interest in this not only through the Natural Resources Conservation Service, but also we're seeing some of the phosphorus trading credit programs also are interested in remandering projects as well.
Our guest today, Peter Jonas, Driftless Area Partnership Specialist for Trout Unlimited, and he'll be with us right up until 12:30 today to talk more about trout and trout stream and trout stream restoration. Jim and Camp Douglas, Eugene and Viola, I hope you can hang around. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on WPR. Larry Mueller here talking about trout stream restoration, getting into fly fishing maybe a bit too with our guest Peter Jonas. Peter is the Driftless Area Partnership Specialist for Trout Unlimited, a great organization. So as we talk with Peter about these Driftless Area and about trout fishing, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about the health of our trout streams in that area? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Jim and Camp Douglas, let's go to you next. Thank you for calling.
Okay, I'm in the Juneau County area and got involved in that stream bank easement project that the DNR funded some years ago. I was wondering, how did that do? And then one other question. I see they do have a catch and release program for fishing trout. My experience is they're pretty sensitive fish, and any handling can pretty much end their life. And I was just wondering why they would do that or if they are still doing it. So I'll hang up and take your answers offline. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling. Right.
Thanks, Jim. So conservation-minded and public-spirited landowners are fundamental to the work that we do in the Driftless, because virtually all of the conservation work we do is on private land. And so to give the public access to that land, we rely most often on easements. Once in a while, a land acquisition, but by and large, an easement. And so first of all, thank you for being willing to provide an easement. And this project is continuing. Both the DNR does easements, but we also have many counties that provide landowners the opportunity to offer a public easement. And in the Northern Driftless, where I live, many easements, in fact, are held by rod and gun clubs. So there are a variety of public entities that administer easements, but they're really essential to our work. Your second question related to catch and release.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, you know, it is true that trout need to be carefully handled and that there is mortality if a fish is hooked very deeply. But there have been on all kinds of research to show that the survival rate is actually quite high for fish that are caught on artificial lures or flies, and by anglers who keep their hands wet, keep the fish in the water most of the time, maybe lift them up for a very quick picture, and let them go. So catch and release has actually been quite successful. But I will say this also about catch and release. We've sometimes, maybe in my personal opinion, made more of a doctrine of it than is really necessary, because the reality of our driftless streams is that a lot of our driftless streams could really use a bit more harvest, frankly. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with harvesting a trout in in most streams that's legal. It's not legal this time of year, by the way. Folks to know that. So you don't go out and do it today. Wait for the first Saturday in May. But where it is legal, many of our driftless streams can support harvest, and particularly if brown trout, they often are out competing brook trout, and doesn't hurt anything to have a few for the skillet.
Thanks again for that question. Duke and Viroqua will go to you next. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Duke. Peter, Duke is a good friend, I got to say, Larry, and he is part of the founding story of TU Dare. So we are being blessed by a giant right now.
Thanks, Peter.
What's on your mind, Duke?
Well, Peter, could you talk briefly about how these thousands of miles of driftless streams got into the degraded condition that they've been in for decades before this restoration work got underway? And can you talk a bit about, for people that aren't anglers, what about how does watershed restoration benefit landowners and other recreationists and communities?
Mm-hmm. All right, Duke, thank you.
I'll make up them. Thanks for the show.
You bet. And this really gets at the heart of what we're about. So when we look at the driftless area historically, once European settlement started to happen in the driftless in the 1800s, and they brought the agricultural methods that they knew at the time, those methods were very hard on our steep hilly landscape and on our Midwestern climate. So that combination led to just enormous amounts of soil coming down from our hillsides into river valleys. So if you go to a typical driftless stream that hasn't been restored, and here you all often find when someone's explaining this, we have to talk with our hands a lot, which doesn't really do any good on radio. But when you go into a stream that isn't restored and you look at it kind of like a cross section, it really sort of looks like a U. In other words, the banks are very steep going down to the stream bed, and the banks in extreme conditions are often unvegetated. They're so steep. And those banks are eroding large quantities of topsoil, and they're also, when they erode, large quantities of phosphorus are going into the water stream. So what we try to do when we restore a stream, the first thing we want to do is it's called giving that stream its floodplain back, or reattaching it to its floodplain. So instead of a U, think of a cross-section of maybe a very shallow custard dish would be, I guess, how I would explain it. And that gives the stream riparian corridor back its ability to support also all kinds of non-game species. In addition, it's not just about trout. And also we can plant prairie grass in that corridor. So we want to work on the shape. By doing that, we, over the lifetime of TU Dare, we keep 17,600 pounds of phosphorus contained per year. That's okay. Phosphorus not going into our water stream. And we contain 50,000 tons of sediment per year. That's sediment that is not going down to the Mississippi Delta. And, I love Wisconsin. I want to keep it here. Louisiana has got more.
They don't need it.
Yeah. They don't want it. They got more than they can use. We want to keep it here. And then finally, by returning that stream to the flood, flood plain. We are really helping that stream to function correctly when floods and high water events come, that instead of that water going down like a fire hose, it is dissipating out during a high water event, and then it is allowing that water to soak in the soil and do its job. So I would say, even if you're not an angler, the work that we're doing is really vital to our society and being able to live in harmony with our environment.
And I did have a caller, you know, and I should have asked or should have mentioned this. A caller wonders, where the heck is, what is the driftless area and, you know, where is it contained and so forth? And I should have just done that right off the bat. So,
well, the driftless area is a four-state area, and it is really named, it's unique in that it's named for something we don't have, which is mainly glacial drift. So we don't have the material that is left behind, like the moraines and other parts of Wisconsin, by the receding glaciers. And what we do have are our marvelous limestone aquifers. And so the streams that run through the driftless are spring creeks. They're refreshed by groundwater. And it's characterized by a very hilly topography and by streams that run at a fairly cold, constant temperature throughout the year. And this area encompasses southwest and west central Wisconsin. It also has some of southeast Minnesota, northeast Iowa, and even just a sliver of northwest Illinois also falls in the driftless topography. And our TU DARE effort does work in all of these states to improve trout streams and watersheds.
We have Eugene and Viola with a comment, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Eugene.
Good afternoon, Larry. You kind of mentioned it earlier, but the Kickapoo here, you've got about a half a dozen trout streams that empty into that, and they stock all these trout streams up in here, and you'll have license plates from all over up in here when the trout season opens.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, there's a big financial boon to the communities from trout fishing.
Absolutely. We've done economic studies. We're due for another one, and millions of dollars in financial activity are generated by trout fishing throughout the driftless every year. And Eugene is really in the heart of it. When you think of the Viroqua area, that is the area that has benefited the most. I will say this about Eugene's comment, though. I think he'd be surprised to know that most of those trout that he's talking about in that area of Wisconsin are actually wild trout. There is still some stocking that goes on, but by and large, those streams have been improved to the point where they have robust natural reproduction. And in Trout Unlimited, you know, all trout are beloved children of God, but we do favor some more than others. And we favor wild native trout, number one, and then wild non-native trout, and then stock trout. So we do have a bit of a hierarchy in terms of the trout we prefer.
And the wild natives are the best to eat, too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
There's
yeah.
no doubt about that. Yeah. Suzanne in Madison, your turn. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello. Thank you for listening to me today. I'm paying tribute to an excellent trout fisher who died 2 weeks ago. His name is Carl Welke. He trout fished his whole life. He was buried in his waders with his creel and his pole and his fishing hat and $5 in his pocket so he can wet his whistle and get to the other side.
Oh, my.
And Carl started an outdoor club at the Weston School District, and they had the biggest club in the entire Weston school system because he taught them how to hunt and trout fish and fish on the Mississippi. And he was a very honorable man who will be missed by many. A few who are listening probably know Carl Welke, and I bid him adieu.
Suzanne, thank you. And did you know, you knew of Carl?
Yep. But I don't believe that I've ever met Carl, but and Suzanne, thank you so much. That is such a touching recollection. And one thing I have found, and one of the reasons why I really wanted to work for Trout Unlimited, is that when we strive for the healing of our natural world, something that goes on during that is the healing of human relationships and the enrichment of our own experience with each other as human beings and as stewards of the land. And I think of the people who mentored me in my fly fishing journey. One of them was a man named Lowell Gingrich, who lived here in Madison. Just a tremendously generous person in terms of his time, and taught me what it meant to live in a way where I was a contributor to the natural world. And, you know, as you spoke so eloquently of Carl, that is what we tried to be about.
Yeah. Absolutely. I saw a piece on Trout Unlimited, a story on Trout Unlimited that you wrote that had me pause to think for a bit. The title of it was, "Are My Secret Streams Really My Secret to Keep?" And I flash back to when I first started. I was interested. I was doing other fishing, but I hadn't done any trout fishing. And I had a friend who said, "Oh, okay, I'm going to tell you where to go, and you will catch trout." And he told me a spot, and I went there, and then I never felt like I could tell anyone else about it, because it felt like it wouldn't have been right for me to do that. But now a lot of years went by, and then there was a young person who wanted to start trout fishing. So that's the only person I ever told, because I thought, well, you can still catch a lot of fish there. and that kind of comes through out in your piece.
Yeah, and I think so much of this is contextual. This article did what I hoped it would do. It really sparked a lot of conversation on our TU online message board and amongst friends and colleagues of mine, and that was my intention. And a lot of it is contextual. So, you know, there are times when a person just kind of shares a piece of information with you, and a condition of the sharing of that is for you to keep it secret. And then I think, you know, you're kind of obliged, although I think there is a statute of limitations, like you experienced with your young person. But I also think we sometimes miss some opportunities. We get so caught up in saving a spot for ourselves, we miss some opportunities to really introduce someone to the joy of angling in a really special place. And being an angler is not the only way to care about cold water resources or to become a conservationist. You know, people develop a passion for conservation issues through a whole variety of avenues, if you will. But it is one very effective way to help a person start to see their connection and their impact on the natural world. And frankly, it's something I'm concerned about, because our numbers of anglers each year are on a decline in the state of Wisconsin, and it seems to be a bit harder to draw people into the outdoor sports. And I think we need to be intentional about that.
And, you know, for maybe spend a minute or two, it doesn't take a lot to get involved in fly fishing. Let's talk about that for a minute. For
right.
somebody who's not done it before.
Right. You know, the main reason, I always fished as a child, but the main reason I got into stream trout fishing was it was financially accessible. I started fishing with a spinning rod, a piece of split shot, a hook, and a worm. And, you know, pretty much you can get yourself going for around $30, you know, and then comes waders and other accoutrements, you might say. But it's a very accessible way to start fishing. And I would say even for fly angling, you know, other anglers will sometimes give us the razz about all of our fancy equipment and so forth. But when you compare that to the cost of a bass boat, I'd say you can be decked out in Orvis and you can still be spending a heck of a lot less money on angling. So, you know, it's a very accessible way to fish, to fish on foot on a trout stream. And there are all kinds of opportunities to get started. You know, your local fly shop is a great resource to look at that. They often sell beginner outfits that are designed for the driftless. So you get the fly rod, the reel, the line, the leader, they'll help you set it up and so forth. A lot of Trout Unlimited chapters and clubs have fishing events where you can learn. And for example, I'm doing an event at the Whitehall Public Library where I'm going to be teaching people how to cast a fly rod and a little bit about how to fish. So we're all of us who are engaged in the sport really realize that we need to be intentional about inviting others to participate in it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was thinking about how I learned to throw a fly rod. My friend took me out in the boat in the lake.
Nothing wrong. A lot easier to lot fewer stuff around for your back cast to get tied up in. So that's not the worst idea. Yeah. I'm actually a big believer of the lawn is the place to start rather than the stream. And try to hit a hat, and then we'll take you out to the stream and see what you can do.
And the trout, what's the address for the online address for Trout Unlimited?
TU.org. Very simple. Very simple.
TU.org. That's the place to go if you want to learn a little more about the restoration projects that are going on, but also to learn about maybe some of those classes or maybe other ways you can get involved with trout fishing and fly fishing. Peter Jonas, I hope you'll come back and be with us again. He's Driftless Area Partnership Specialist for Trout Unlimited. And thank you so much for listening in today. Tomorrow we'll talk with an author about losing a spouse, and we'll also talk with a psychologist about that same topic. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on WPR. I'm Larry Mueller.